Greetings, humans. You have entered the Command Zone, your destination for all aspects of Elder Dragon Highlander. Enjoy your stay.
Here comes the part of the episode where I can't think of a sound.
We used to have no problem with this. Now you just make up
Hooked on a feeling.
Hooked on a feeling. Where'd that come from?
I was thinking about Guardians of the Galaxy earlier today.
Nice.
Yeah.
Ooga chaga. Ooga chaga. Ooga chaga. Ooga chaga.
What a ridiculous intro to a song.
But it works.
Yeah. Someone went into a studio. There was someone across in the soundproof glass looking at them. And they go, and they heard that. Tick, tock, tock, tock. And the guy just went, ooga chaga. Ooga. It's like, well, that's ridiculous. Who does that? Anyway, welcome to the Command Zone, everybody. My name is Jimmy Wong.
How's it? It's Josh Lee Kwai.
We have a fun one today. We're back to top 10s. We're talking about top 10 lands in Elder Dragon Highlander, also known as Commander, the format we all play.
Top 10 lists, we're back.
Yeah, it's always a good time to do top 10 lists. It also is always fun because we've had a few, I think at the beginning of our top 10 lists, we didn't have a bunch that matched up in the top five. And then as we got further into the show, more of our top five just overlapped.
Yeah, this one actually, there's more difference than I thought there would be. So
yeah,
that's good. It also ties into last week because we were talking about Gitrog and lands important. So this is sort of like, maybe that's why we decided to do this. I have no idea, honestly.
Me neither.
Sometimes we're just like, we should do that. And we're like, yeah. And you don't realize it subconsciously. It's because the last show was about lands,
I'll take this moment to mention as well, people always ask about our Deck Doctors episode, and they keep sending us submissions. By the way, keep doing that. That's great. We love getting them. But it takes a lot of work, and for Josh right now, you're super swamped. I'm pretty busy in these next couple of weeks as well, and it's just tough because it's like you have to dedicate like 4 or 5 hours to coming up with the topic and really fleshing it out, and then just keep refining it for a few more after that.
Yeah, and Deck Doctors takes even longer. Again, we do want to get back to it. Keep sending in the submissions. We are going to. It's just we have to find that window. Yeah, it's super busy time for me. Summer movie season is upon us.
Yeah, so it's going to be a good one, by the way.
It's going to be a huge one. There's a lot of stuff. There's pretty much a lot of superheroes fighting each other.
Nice.
Because if you go Batman, Superman, Civil War, X-Men, and... what's the other one? There's a fourth one.
Doctor Strange?
No,
he's not fighting really anyone.
Dang it. I lost it. There's a
the
fourth
Jungle
one.
Book.
And Alice Through the Looking Glass. No. Whatever. There's a fourth one where superheroes are fighting each other. So
nice. Is it Jace versus Chandra? They're like our magic superheroes, right?
Yeah, it's a dual deck.
Yeah, it's a dual deck, straight up. Yeah, dual deck will be coming out this summer, probably at some time. I hope so. Yeah, that's great. It is a busy time. I love the summer, though, because the show started during the summer originally, actually.
Yeah.
Conspiracy.
Yeah. So, no, it's a great time for movies. It's really cool, but it just, the work gets swamped. So
yes, but we will get back to it. Don't worry, folks. We'll get there.
So the Zendikar art book that everyone, man, a lot of people wanted to get a hold of this book. So.
This book is sweet. I have a copy. I was given an extra one, so I was like, I have to give this away. What am I going to do with this? Keep it sealed?
So
it's not,
generous.
It's not magic products.
Yeah,
it's a book.
So we're going to announce that at the end of the show. If you did enter, you can either fast forward right now. Do people fast forward anymore? You can click to the end of the show and then listen to see if you won, or you can just wait.
If you're in your car, you shouldn't be clicking because that's illegal. You should have played the podcast, and like at this point, you are pulling out of like your neighborhood and onto the freeway.
It's very specific.
I don't know. I guess it depends on, some people might be driving on country roads for a while. Who knows?
Oh, something I wanted to clarify from last episode, because I guess we sort of get into this bubble where we're used to doing the show and we're used, you know, we're aware of what all the episodes were and everything we've talked about in the past, but we picked up a lot of new listeners. And so a lot of people were asking, they were like, 5-color Gitrog, are you just running an illegal deck or what? So something we haven't actually touched on in the show in a while, but we talked about early on, was something that I like to do, and that's build a commander deck that's based around a commander, but that commander is actually not your general. It actually goes into the deck. So we'll refer to my 5-color Nekusar deck. So it's a deck about making everybody draw cards and therefore take damage from having a lot of cards either in their hand or drawn. But there's a lot of redundancy for that effect in the history of Magic. And so what I did is I built a deck that's 5-color, and it actually runs Chromat as the general, but everybody in our playgroup knows it's a Nekusar deck.
Yeah.
Even though Nekusar himself doesn't even always come out every game, sometimes Underworld Dreams, which is another thing that punishes you for drawing cards or other cards like that, are really the thing that kills everybody or KOs them. But that's so when we refer to a five-color Marchesa deck, that's the same thing. That's just Child of Alara is actually the commander, but it's still a Marchesa deck.
Yeah, we talked about Altered Ego on the other show, which is a green and blue clone spell that gives +1/+1 counters. And we're like, oh, this would be great in your Marchesa deck. And it was like, green's not Marchesa. It's
right,
like,
but my Marchesa deck is five color,
yep,
specifically so that it can have green, because that's the +1/+1 counter color. So
yeah,
that when I was saying make a five color Gitrog deck, it was actually the idea of running, I don't know, Sliver Queen or something as the commander. You rarely cast the commander in these decks.
Yeah.
Or maybe Child of Alara.
Child of Alara seems like one of the best ones just because
it's good to just have a board wipe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you're probably going to have some sack outlets in there as well.
Yeah.
You should if you have Child as your main guy. Actually, five color is always an option in our play group. It should be, I think. We have the mana base for it. Khonza's Tarkir came out. You should have fetch lands if you played that set, you know.
And that has all the tri-lands. Like, you can easily run all 10 tri-lands.
Yeah.
The fetch lands. You can do a five color deck. The pain lands, and you're good.
Yeah. You don't even need the fetch lands.
It's true. You can go 10 tri-lands, 10 life lands, 10 guild gates. You're pretty much good.
Mm-hmm.
So, that is, when we say five color, that's what we're talking about. So that was the idea with that Gitrog deck, was to take Titania, Omnath, Gitrog, jam them all into the 99, and actually run Child of Alara or another Wooburg commander.
Nice.
And make the deck work that way. So
good times all around, I'd say.
Good to clarify.
Yeah. Also, Josh, you had a fun little Saturday last Saturday. I wasn't there for it, but you texted me pictures of a whiteboard, and I immediately, the second I got that image, I was like, oh, I am now officially jealous I couldn't be there.
So it's sort of become a playgroup tradition, and you've been there for other ones, but not this one, where when a new set comes out, our playgroup gets together, we go to a local gaming store, we pick up a whole lot of product, and then the entire day, that Saturday, when the sets first come out, we draft all day long, and usually we draft and only play a match or two, and then draft again and play a match or two, and we up the ante this time. We actually had a big whiteboard, and each person kept track of what decks they drafted, how the deck did, and what their impressions were. Like, were there cards that overperformed? Were there cards that underperformed? And so we had this great back and forth between the entire playgroup where everyone was like, I drafted green-black. It felt like this. This card actually did better than I thought. This card I thought was good, but it actually sucked. Here was my record. And then, you know, we drafted four or five times. So each person had a column on the whiteboard, and it sort of said the five decks that they drafted, what the record was, all that stuff. It was super fun.
I loved seeing everyone's individual like notes, because it really reflected the individual. Like, because we play Commander with these guys too, so it's always awesome to see how they describe cards, how they think about, you know, what their tendencies are and stuff. It was like you guys had a mini Pro Tour testing group minus the actual seriousness of a Pro Tour testing group.
Yeah, that's true. Like, it was still like pretty loose. And the other great thing is, you know, we were drafting to figure out the format as much as you can in one day. And so after you would draft, you'd lay it out and everybody would look around and go like, oh, you were drafting this, you were drafting that. And you sort of got a good look at, you know, how many people could draft a single color or how deep the colors were or that kind of stuff.
Yeah, totally.
So we don't talk about draft a lot on the show, obviously, because it's a Commander show, but I did want to touch on it a little bit because it is fun and it's a new format and a lot of our listeners do draft. If you don't, you can skip this part. We're going to talk about top 10 lands in EDH. You can skip ahead. We're just going to touch on it really quick because it is in the world of Magic and it is cool and we don't get to talk about it a lot. Maybe we'll do a sideboard episode where we go in more in depth.
I like the sideboard episodes because I play a lot of Limited. So.
Yeah. So, and you've drafted the set a lot, Jimmy. So what have your impressions been of it so far?
It's very fun. For me so far, like every time I've drafted it, and usually you get the first time you open the packs for the first time you draft, you're like, wow, this is cool, like all these new interactions. But it's not the same when you're doing like a core set or even the small set of a big one or whatever, you combine them together. Battle for Zendikar had a certain zest to it, but Shadows of Innistrad, I can understand now why everyone loved Innistrad so much the first time, because you're drafting things that you are really familiar with.
Yeah, flavor-wise, it's really cool.
Vampire, yeah, like all these things, we've seen stories of them, and like we've grown up with movies and stuff and comics and all that stuff. Like, you don't grow up with comics of Eldrazi.
It's true.
They're cool, but they're not as fun and flavorful as the Transform cards are. So it's been a lot of fun so far. Whether or not it's a balanced and even draft format, I'm not entirely sure yet, but so far I've had a lot of fun.
Yeah, it feels pretty good. I would say, like, Battle for Zendikar, we all found out pretty early that green was really bad, and that sort of hurt that format, I think, that you couldn't really draft green, so there was really only four colors to draft.
Green's now very good in this draft format.
I think green's probably the best color. It's almost certainly the best color in Shadows over Innistrad. It's the deepest.
It's the deepest. It's, you always want to dip a toe in green, is what it feels like.
It felt like almost every draft, once we flipped over, everybody flipped over the card, started laying out their deck, there was more green drafted than any other color.
Interesting.
Just because it was the deepest. I think the green-red werewolf's archetype is the best. I think
pretty sweet.
Yeah, I don't know if the best version of that is better than the best version of certain other decks, but I think consistency-wise and sort of the ease of drafting it, it's a very easy deck to draft. That, I think, is the sort of strongest. And as we looked at our board after the day was done, it did have the best win percentage.
Mm-hmm.
So that doesn't say everything, but I think that's an indicator.
I do like green-red. Two of my favorite colors right there.
One of the great things about drafting green-red is a lot of your cards are the dual-face cards. And so you can basically tell the entire table, hey, I'm drafting green-red, because when you draft the dual-face cards, you actually have to announce it. And the reason behind announcing the dual face cards when you draft them is because that negates the advantage someone sitting close to you would have, because they would be able to look and see that you drafted that card, but somebody on the other side of the table wouldn't even be able to see. So that's why they require in a live draft for you to announce it. But imagine in a regular draft, if you could just say, hey guys, I'm drafting green and red. If you could just tell the people next to you, because a lot of drafting is actually trying to cooperate with the people next to you without being allowed to actually cooperate. You don't want to be in red if they're in red, and you don't want to be in green if they're in green.
It's like hidden teamwork.
Yeah, but the person next to you doesn't want to be in the colors that you're in. So a lot of times, if they could, they'd be like, you're in those colors? Okay, good. Then I know I should be in these colors.
Mm-hmm.
And this sort of allows you to do it because of the dual face cards.
Yeah, it's made drafting a lot smoother, I've found. Everyone, at the end of the table, I always like to look around and see what everyone's in. If the table's not serious and they don't care, like, oh, I'm in these colors. Just to see how the colors balanced out, who got what, who decided to stick with their bomb, and how that affected the rest of the draft. Because these are all sort of like precautionary things you need to look out for in order to make sure that you get the best deck out of the cards that are given to you.
Yeah.
Pretty crazy stuff.
Yeah,
I love it.
Super fun. If you haven't tried Shadows over Innistrad draft, I would say check it out. I'm not saying it's going to be the best draft format of all time. It's hard to tell. I think I can already tell it's not as good as Khans, because Khans was awesome. But it could be. It's probably better than Battle for Zendikar, which was kind of stinky. I think Oath was a little bit better than BFZ, just because it brought five colors. Like, you could actually draft all of the colors. Not five
a
colors.
Personal joy
but
for Josh
each
Lee
color.
Clark.
Sorry, I meant green was alive.
There you
actually,
go. Yeah.
Actually, Oath did have a five color deck that was actually decent too. So, all right. Enough about draft. I know I'm annoying some people.
You know, we're talking about it because we're passionate about it. So, if you guys actually want to see a sideboard episode, let us know, because it's just more content for you guys, obviously, but it's also fun for us to talk about. And, you know, we've talked about Commander for 104 episodes now.
And we talked about Draft for one. Yeah. No, we talked about Conspiracy for a couple, so maybe three or four total.
Yeah, actually, that's a good sign. We started off our show, and then immediately we're like, let's talk about Conspiracy.
It's close to Commander. It's basically...
They did use the command zone, in all fairness, so... Yeah. All right, then. Let's move on and talk about our top 10 lands in Commander. Now, we've done this a bunch, obviously. The first restriction that we always put on these is that we're not going to name any lands that are over $25.
Tabernacle at Pendril Vale is my number one, though.
Yeah, Gaia's Cradle.
Sarah's Sanctum.
Easily my number one is Gaia's Cradle. That land is beyond absurd. But yeah, all these lands are obviously powerful. They also cost 50, 100, 600. So yes, they're going to be number one, or they're going to be high up there, but they're also just not accessible for players.
And for all you smart Alex out there, we're not talking about the Expedition versions. We're talking about the non. So that's how we get under $25.
Yeah, exactly.
I know what you're about to do. Just, you don't have to type that now.
You can type it in your head.
So that's the first thing. We sort of steered away from like fetch lands, dual lands, mana creating, just, you know, those type of lands. We've talked about those plenty. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about sort of non-mana producing lands, or at least in the traditional sense.
Yeah, they may produce mana, but overall they're more just utility.
Yeah.
Or sometimes game breaking, depending on the lands. So we're not going to talk about Command Tower, because yes, that is a great land in Commander.
You just put it in every deck.
Fetch lands, duh. Shock lands, duels, all that good stuff. So we're going to talk about our top 10 favorite lands. And it was an interesting one. There are a lot of things to think about when doing this.
Yeah. So really quickly, we'll go over sort of how we come to how we rank them personally. So we use a few criteria. One is how useful is the land in a multitude of decks or color combinations. So it'll get knocked a little bit if it's only useful with one color. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean it can't still be in the top 10 or can't be high in there.
Yeah, if the power level's there, power level's there.
The quadrant theory, which is something we borrowed from Limited Resources, the idea of how does this land play in the early stages of the game?
Mm-hmm.
How does it play when you're at parity? How does it play when you're behind? And how does it play when you're winning? And then does the land either combat a strategy, which is prevalent in EDH, or enable a strategy, which is prevalent in EDH? So we've had a few episodes like the Voltron or the Token archetype series, but there's a whole bunch of archetypes, you know, control, aggro, blah, blah, blah. Does this land fit into or stop one of those things that a pillar of the format that you're likely to see very often?
Right. Or if we could include Gaia's Cradle, obviously it'd be support the token.
Exactly.
Or just any deck that puts creatures
in. Or any deck that has green.
Yeah, pretty much.
All right. You want to go first with your number 10?
Yes, I would love to go first. My number 10 land is Temple of the False God. Now, this is a card that has been in a lot of the Commander products. In fact, I think it's been in every single one of the Commander products. It says, tap to add two colorless mana to your mana pool. Activate this ability only if you control five or more lands. I'm a huge fan of the ability to add more than one colorless mana on a card. And Temple of the False Gods, I think, has the best, I guess, quote-unquote, penalty on it. Because some of their land, there are some lands like City of Traders requires you to sacrifice land. Some lands don't even allow you to tap other, like play new lands, and then when you do, you just have to sacrifice that land. City of Traders is exactly that, actually.
There was a land in Battle for Zendikar, I think, that once you have seven lands.
Shrine of the Forsaken Gods.
Yes.
Yeah, where it adds two to your mana pool, but you only can cast colorless spells with it, and only if you have seven or more lands.
Yeah, so there's two penalties on that one, and it's worse than Temple of the False Gods. It's actually a direct, homage to Temple of the Forsaken Gods, right? Shrine of the Forsaken gods, Temple of the False Gods.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And for the Forsaken Gods, I love the flavor on it. It's actually the three titans. But yeah, Temple of the False God, I like it. It's now, if you have this in your opening hand, it's not good, right?
Unless you have four other lands or three.
Even three lands. Yeah.
I think the thing people don't remember is Temple of the False God, it can be the fifth land.
Yeah.
You don't have to have five other lands. You just have to have four and it.
Yeah. And what that means is if you have no mana rocks in turn five, you go from five mana to six mana. And there are a lot of really powerful cards in EDH at six.
It just ramps you for nothing. I mean, it didn't cost you anything to do that.
Didn't cost anything to do it. I think if you're in a deck that would like to play lands in general, you should play a Temple of the False Gods. It's one of those sort of goes in every deck, has a slight downside. You don't want to see it early in the game, so it's not super high on the list, but it's up there for me.
Yeah, I would say that in general, the only decks that wouldn't want to run it are like Wooburg decks because they have so many colors. But I even run them in those because those decks have things like Chromatic Lantern and Urborg, and that turns the Temple of the False Gods into a normal land for those times when it's your fifth when it's not your fifth land.
Yeah,
so, okay, my number 10 is the most Josh land. It is Minamo, School at Water's Edge.
It's a legendary land.
So Minamo is a legendary land. It comes into play untapped. You can tap it for blue mana, or you can pay a blue and tap it and untap target legendary permanent.
Do you run any legendaries in your commander deck?
Yeah, you might. You might.
Maybe.
It's so good because any legendary that taps and does something, that's a very powerful thing that it's doing. It's a legendary creature that's tapping and doing something. By the way, it says legendary permanent, so if you wanted to tap... If you had another legendary land or something like that, is Pyromancer's Goggles a legendary artifact?
I think it is. Belong to a Pyromancer.
By the way, pick those up now because there's a deck in Standard that's got Pyromancer's Goggles, and it's actually don't pick those up now. Wait now until it rotates because it just shot up in price. Anyway, love Minamo because, as we know, I love tap effects.
Yeah.
So being able to do it twice for just two extra mana because you have to tap Minamo and something else is oftentimes crazy powerful. Think of like Galena. Oh, steal two legendary.
Oh, goodness. Rune?
Rune. Oh, flicker two things. I mean, That is really, really powerful. So, yep, that's my number 10.
Good stuff, Minamo. This is a card that I first saw. It was like my first commander deck ever. I only got one, and later on I was looking at it and went, it should be in every blue deck.
It really almost
There's no reason not to. It comes in untapped. It's essentially an island.
And worst case scenario, you just attack and then untap your thing.
Yeah.
Even if it doesn't have a tap effect, it's still decent. It still does.
Pseudo-vigilant, yeah. Yep. It's interesting because looking at this card, you would wonder, you know, there's hidden text on cards, I think, that make them good. For instance, a card that doesn't say comes into the battlefield tapped could also say comes into the battlefield untapped, and that you should look at that and be like, that's actually an upside. My number 9 is the one, the only, Reliquary Tower. It's a very simple land. It just says you have no maximum hand size, and you can tap it to add a colorless mana to your mana pool.
This is another, like, every deck just about wants this card. If you've built your deck correctly, then it wants Reliquary Tower.
Yeah.
The only ones, the decks that don't want it, which never get above 7 cards, you did something wrong there.
Yeah. Even Boros decks, if you built them correctly, should probably get to the Reliquary Tower stage.
The cost of having it is just so low. It's just a land. It gives you no maximum hand size. Like, it's great.
Again, if you're running like 5 color, it's slightly more powerful, less powerful. But at the end of the day, like, there's nothing more satisfying than having a lot of cards in your hand and not having to discard any of them.
I actually have decks where I run, like, you know, Expedition Map and stuff just so that I can find just Reliquary Tower because it's so important to certain decks. Yeah, I have it a little higher on the list, but it is very, very good. My number 9 is, I believe this is on the reserve list. It's Yavimaya Hollow.
This card's great.
Yeah, it's a legendary land, so you can untap it with Minamo.
Oh.
It comes into play untapped. You can tap it to add 1 diamond mana to your mana pool.
Colorless.
Or you can pay a green and tap it to regenerate target creature.
Any creature.
It just saves your creature. I mean, it doesn't save them from Path to Exile or whatever, but it saves it from destroy effects.
Yeah.
And damage effects.
A Voltron Commander swinging in. You can chump block it. Yeah, you can keep chump blocking it.
Yep. Somebody does like a, well, not Wrath of God because it says cannot be regenerated, but Supreme Verdict. Mm-hmm. You can regenerate it. It's super powerful, and people forget that it's there. And in so many instances, I've been able to be like, okay, I saved this guy. And they're like, what? Oh, no, because you have that one key creature. You know, back in the Prophet of Krufix days, having this in Prophet was like, made it, you know, twice as hard to get rid of that. So when you have Consecrated Sphinx or, you know, even like Deadeye Navigator and stuff like that, it just makes it that much easier to protect that one creature.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the card is absurd. I love that card. It's so cheap is the other thing. It doesn't, like, a lot, the newer cards are, the more they cost to do their abilities.
Yes.
Like Manlands and Folklands, they didn't make them like they used to.
In my day.
So you have My Hollow is an excellent card. And for just a green, regenerate target creature. And you can do it on someone else's too. You can like really blow someone out if they don't realize like, oh, cool, I can like get rid of this thing finally. And I'm like, nah, how about I save that because it's actually helping me out.
Yeah, that's true.
My number 8 is much higher on your list. This is the second crossover we had. It is High Market.
It's higher on my list. Yeah, it's way up on my list. I have it at number 3.
Yeah. I mean, now that I look at your list and look at mine, I probably would actually put this higher up because the number of decks I put this into going, I can't believe this isn't in there.
I don't think I have a single deck that doesn't have High Market in it. And maybe this is a holdover from the Tuck days, but
yeah,
having a sacrifice effect is so, so often... So often something happens and you're like, I need to be able to sack that creature for no effect, just to put it back in the command zone or just so that it doesn't go into exile or
get stolen is the big one. Yeah, for me, High Market is pretty simple though. Comes in untapped, add colorless to your mana pool, or you can tap it to sacrifice a creature. You gain 1 life. Who cares about the life? Instant speed sack outlet as soon as you play it. Doesn't need haste. So High Market is obviously on my list. It's much higher than yours. I think I'd actually move it higher if I got a little time to edit this list and get back to it, you know.
It just depends on how you're weighting it. Like, I was clearly weighting mine towards like how many of my decks either have or would want this card.
Mm-hmm.
Like, some of the ones higher on the list, I don't have unlimited numbers, so I have to choose which decks get it. But would I put this card in every deck? And High Market, I literally think I do have in every commander deck. Maybe I've got one that doesn't.
It's pretty good. Pretty, pretty good. Actually, kind of ties into your number 8.
Yeah, it's true. They have similar effects. Or you have them in for similar reasons. So my number 8 is Homeward Path. It's a land. It comes into play untapped. Tap to add colorless or diamond to your mana pool. And then you can tap, and each player gains control of all creatures he or she owns.
Hmm.
So you just get back all your creatures that were stolen. And everybody gets back their creatures that were stolen.
Yeah, this literally negates Insurrection immediately.
Yep, boom. You just get it. Control magic effects. Silumgar is an entire deck. There's there's a lot of decks. In fact, because of the Deck Doctor series, we get to see like a whole ton of people submitting decks to us. And decks that clone and steal everybody's stuff are extremely prevalent. A lot of people build that type of deck. And having a card that basically stops their main thing that they're trying to do is so powerful. Even if it's not their main thing, though, Memnarch or, you know, Galena, those cards that go in decks, even if you're not just doing that. I mean, Memnarch, obviously, you can just have be your thing. Galena, too, I guess.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. Homeward Path is silver bullet against that type of effect.
Yeah, and it's never bad. You play that card, even if the card isn't stolen and you play it, everyone that has those abilities, their cards are kind of dead now.
Yeah.
Because it's not just one. It's not just choose one, sacrifice this land. It's every single person gets their things, their creatures back.
Yeah, you don't have to sacrifice the Homeward Path. You just tap it and get all your stuff back. Everybody gets their stuff back. And then it's just ready to use again. So, super good.
Count me in. I actually didn't have my list. So sad. Considering probably actually all my deck steals stuff, which is probably why.
You're on the other side. You're like, I don't want people to play that card.
Yeah, exactly. I'll play a High Market before I play a Homeward Path. Next up on my list is Academy Ruins. It's the first of my cards that can only go in blue decks or a certain color of a deck. It's a legendary land. You can untap it with Manamo. Tap it to add colorless to your mana pool, or for one in the blue, tap it, put target artifact card from your graveyard on top of your library. Now, this may be meta specific for us, but I found that a Gilded Lotus gets gotten rid of very quickly on our boards by either a Fracturing Gust.
Vandal Blast.
Just even targeted removal will get rid of a Gilded Lotus sometimes. Sometimes someone will also Thad Adel and just steal it out of your deck.
Yeah, true.
Anyway.
Not just that. Thrawn Dynamos, Soul Rings. Your deck is very unlikely to not have artifacts in it.
Yeah, when I first started playing the format, artifacts were kind of indestructible overall, and then the more I played, I realized that they are just as fragile as everything else. So Academy of Ruins is great. It also triggers a lot of crazy combos with different cards and different decks, being able to recur an artifact over and over again, especially with card draw. But it's also just a great rescue. It's always nice to know that, because sometimes someone will have like a Nevermiril's Disc out, right?
Yeah.
And they'll have a Gilded Lotus in my hand, and they'll think, well, I don't want to play this Lotus, even though it could really ramp me and get me ahead.
So but I don't want to just play it into like it's going to get destroyed right away. Yeah.
So Academy Ruins is an awesome insurance policy, and that's why I love that card.
I mean, every deck has a certain amount of artifacts. I think that artifacts, and for that reason, artifacts are the second most likely thing behind creatures to get destroyed.
Yeah.
Because every deck's going to run some artifact removal. Not every deck will run enchantment removal. It probably should, but or at least not a lot.
Not every deck even can.
But every single commander deck is going to, you know, you're going to play against is going to have at least Soul Ring and probably, you know, Thrawn Dynamo, Gilded Lotus, maybe Sensei's Divining Top, depending on your play group. There's a lot of ubiquitous artifacts in the format.
Yep, very true.
My number 7, I went round and round between Alchemist Refuge and this. Alchemist Refuge is better for sure, but it's two color, and Winding Canyons, which is what I decided to go with as my number 7, goes in any deck, so I chose that.
Yeah, this is still a great card.
It comes into play untapped. You can tap it and add one colorless to your mana pool. Or you can pay two and tap it, and until end of turn, you may play creature cards whenever you could play instants. So it gives all your creatures flash.
Wow.
Really, really powerful. We talk a lot about Vedalken Orrery and how good that is and why, because it allows you to sort of change where you're sitting at the table, basically. Mm-hmm. And this is another of that type of effect. And if you need to do things like play a creature and make sure that it survives a rotation of the table, well, it's way better if you just have to play it and then it has to survive that end step.
Yeah.
And now you get to untap with it, which is what you can do with cards like this.
Yeah, Winding Canyons is absurd because, like you said, Alchemist Refuge, which does it for green and the blue, but is for any card.
Right.
I mean, in the right deck, Winding Canyons is probably just better. It doesn't require a huge tax on your mana. The fact that any deck can play it is really powerful. When I first made my list, I actually put this side by side by Alchemist Refuge, but I think this is actually better. in general.
I didn't want to cheat and put both. I almost did, but I decided, Winding Canyons. The downside is, yes, you can't play sorceries, artifacts, enchantments as though they had flash, but the upside being that it can go in decks that aren't specifically green-blue is huge. If it was just green or just blue, I probably would have said Alchemist Refuge. But because it's a specific two-color combination, that cuts it out of a lot of decks.
Mm-hmm. And I think this is great in a deck like Rakdos, Lord of Riots, because you can just, that is something you're always looking to do, is with use this card and put out giant fatties.
Especially, and Rakdos is a good example of those color combinations that aren't super good at protecting their own stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're not in white, blue, and a little bit green, then it's hard for you to guarantee that something's going to survive because you don't have counterspells and you don't have, you can't like suddenly make it indestructible. You know, black, I guess, can get it back from the graveyard. Red, really, what's it got to do? It's got to just play it out there and cross its fingers. It doesn't have a whole bunch of like protect my dude stuff. So Winding Canyon sort of works in that manner sort of also. And also, those colors want haste. Mm-hmm. This is a way to sort of give virtual haste.
I love virtual haste. Just get them.
Just get him.
Okay, my number six. It's a bit of a tie.
Talking about cheating.
I know, I'm cheating. so I'll talk about the one that I originally had as my number one, and I'll talk about the secondary version. It is Vesuva. It's a land, and it's all it says is you may have Vesuva enter the battlefield tapped as a copy of any land on the battlefield. Flavor text, it is everywhere you've ever been.
Wow. It's everywhere. Been.
Pretty flavorful. The other card that I was going to mention is Thespian Stage, which does the same thing, except it adds a colorless without having to copy a land. And for two colorless or two generic, you can tap it and it becomes a copy of a target land and then gains this ability. So it's not immediately comes in as that land. You have to pay a little extra mana, tap in. You can't use it that turn, probably.
Yeah, it's weird because Vesuva.
Who knows?
Is actually closer to Clone, and Thespian Stage is actually closer to Vesuvan Doppelganger.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
It should have been the other way around, but that's just the way they decided to do it, because Vesuvan Doppelganger can reclone different things every upkeep, and Thespian Stage basically can reclone when it feels like it. And Vesuva can only clone once.
Yeah. And I feel like this is even cheating, because Vesuva says, I can be any of your top 10 lands at any time.
Yeah, but it's great. I thought about putting it on there. The fact of the matter is I don't run it in a ton of decks because I don't feel the need to have two of a lot of these. Mm-hmm. Like Reliquary Tower, two of them does nothing.
Right.
You know, obviously Homeward Path, I think two of them is not that great. There's certain ones that are good, though. Two Winding Canyons, you don't really need that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So that's why I left it off. But it was definitely like on my short list and it was tough to cut it.
Mm-hmm. Vesuva's great if your friend has a Gaea's Cradle and you don't.
Yeah, that was really true.
Vesuva's great if someone's playing an Enter the Battlefield ability card and you cannot, and you want that ability. You know, of course, obviously, if it's like you need to pay this color mana to activate the land, then you don't want to copy those lands. It's also great in a pinch to fix.
Yep.
So I like it, sort of a very overall utility land. I just got a bunch of them because I want to start playing them in more decks and to see if they are as effective as I think they are.
They're good. Okay, my number six.
Oh, speaking of lands that Vesuva can copy.
Yeah, this is one you would want to. My number six is Cabal Coffers. This is, well, let me read it. It's a land, comes into play untapped. You pay two mana and tap it. Add black to your mana pool for each swamp you control.
Oh, boy.
So this is just extremely powerful in mono black. It also combos well with Urborg, which makes every land a swamp in addition to its other types.
Mm-hmm.
It doubles your mana in that case. If you're mono black, it just always doubles your mana. Even if you're in two color, it will basically give you, you know, this will tap for somewhere around, I don't know, 10 to 14 mana.
Yeah.
And then sometimes it just taps for 50. Like, that's the crazy times you've seen. We've all seen this happen where somebody has Cabal Coffers and a whole bunch of other stuff, and they just, you're like, how many mana do you have? And they're like, 87.
Double.
Yeah. That is the kind of thing that it can allow. So just one of those broken mana producing cards.
Yeah, anytime you can double your mana, essentially, it's a pretty good bet.
I'd say you probably want to do that.
Yeah. Let's see here. We are on to numero cinco. My numero cinco is your numero uno, so let's skip it for me.
Okay, well, my number five was Reliquary Tower, which you already talked about. So we're on to number four.
Perfect. Not my number four is your number two. This is when we're gonna share some of the same numbers.
We're gonna start to overlap. So go ahead.
Yeah, it is strip mine, strip mine, strip mine, strip mine. Now, a card like strip mine has been seen across the board in many different versions. It's a land that adds colorless, and you can tap it to sacrifice it to destroy target land. This bears comparison to Wasteland.
Not Wasteland is supposedly the fair version.
Right. Because it's destroy target.
Strip mine. And non-basic. We found out that the fair version of strip mine is actually still broken.
Yeah. You can get any land with it. It is an incredibly powerful card. This is another one of those cards that I think you should run in every EDH deck.
Yeah, if you can. Well. It's not super cheap. This is one of those cards that I would put in every deck, but I only have a certain amount. I think I have like 5 or 6. And so I just have to choose which decks they go in, but...
You're just going to buy all the expeditions of it, right?
Right.
clearly.
Yeah, because I'm made of money.
Yeah.
Yeah, this card's been broken since it was printed. It was, you know, banned, restricted, blah, 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 all kinds of stuff. Still is very, very... In you know, the original formats.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very, very powerful. It just... It's not counterable.
Mm-hmm.
With regular counter spells, anyway. And... It counts as a land that taps for mana. If it didn't tap for mana, maybe. But the fact that it comes in untapped and can tap for mana, so it just doesn't really cost you anything. And then when you need to get rid of that, you know, they've got a Gaea's Cradle, boom, just done. Gone. Yeah.
I enjoy anything that allows you to sort of... it's not breaking the game, but it's definitely taking advantage of an old card that they didn't get to oversee sort of the power level of
it.
As time goes on, the developers have more cards in their backlog to reference to know what they should and shouldn't do. Strip Mine came around during a time when that was not really a thing. So that's why it's probably the best sack kill a land card out there.
I mean, think they would never in a million years print this card now. They won't even print like destroy target land for 3 mana anymore.
Right.
As a sorcery. Like they would never make like a land that just comes in and immediately blows away another land.
I mean, that's why Wasteland...
zero casting cost destroy target land spell.
That's why Wasteland's so good in Legacy. I mean, it's just one of those great cards.
Yep. Okay. My number... What were we on? Four?
Number four, yeah.
My number four is your number two. Well, that's okay, because your number four was my number two.
Yeah, hit it.
Wait a minute. You have this card higher than I have it?
Yeah, it's an atrocity.
I'm so ashamed of myself.
Of yourself?
Yeah, because it's like...
Maybe
this
I
is
should...
one of my pet cards, I know, and you ranked it higher than I did.
It wasn't deliberate, I swear.
Oh, man.
I know Josh is going to probably put this in his top five.
Yeah.
It's not going to be his number one. I'm going to put it at two.
You just totally... that hurts me.
I'm stealing your thunder, Josh.
It's
sorry.
Glacial Chasm, everybody. I have talked about this card a bunch. I'll
what
read
a
it.
Card.
It's a great card. So it's a land. Cumulative upkeep of pay two life. Cumulative upkeep means that on your upkeep, you pay this. But each subsequent upkeep, you have to pay it twice. So you pay two life, then you pay four life on your next upkeep. Then it's six, then it's eight. Then it's 10. It goes up by 2. So after a while, it's untenable. You have to either sack
you will
it
die
or
to
you
it,
die
yeah.
to it. Yeah. Glacial Chasm also says, when Glacial Chasm enters the battlefield, sacrifice a land. It also says, creatures you control can't attack. So it's really bad so far. You have to pay 2 life that increases, 2 to 4 to 6 to 8, blah, blah, blah. You can't attack, and you have to sack a land when it comes in. But the upside on the card says, prevent all damage that would be dealt to you.
Boom.
Boom.
All damage, not creature damage, not spell damage, just all damage.
You just can't take damage.
Yeah.
You can have loss of life.
You were across the glacial chasm. Someone's just sitting there looking at you being like, what the heck?
They're like, how do I get to that guy? He's on the other side of that chasm.
But he's like bleeding out really slowly. Or he's getting frostbite, probably.
This card is so good in any deck that's not winning by attacking with creatures. And it's also good in many decks that are.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't have to attack to win, then Glacial Chasm should 100% be in your deck, and it will win you games.
Yeah, you play this, and someone that is like a Mizzix deck would just look at it and go, ew.
I mean, so many decks, the Rafik decks, the token decks, they're going to try to kill you with damage. Like, if they're going to mill you out, then that's the only way they can really go. There's probably a couple other ones I'm not thinking of, but they can't even, like, they can't earthquake you out. They can't attack you out.
At the very least, it gives you a new lease on life that you can eventually get rid of. So if it's a 4-player game, someone's going at you with Infect, you're at 8 Infect, you can just be like, all right, I play Glacial Chasm. you cannot do any damage to me. The infect player, unless they can destroy that land, has to turn to someone else. That gives you a brand new lease on life. That gives you probably, because you haven't been playing Life for Infect, like 5-6 turns with this land out if you want to build up your board and just be okay.
Well, and the funny thing is that sounds not that good, but 5 or 6 turns is usually the game's over. Like, yeah. Usually you play Glacial Chasm somewhere around turn 5 or 6, and the game only goes to turn 12 or 13. Like, it feels like Commander games go really, really long
mm-hmm.
because there's so many players and it does take a lot of time, but they rarely go to, like, turn 20. Mm-hmm. They very often are over around turn 14. So a lot of times you can play Glacial Chasm and you're like, I have enough life to just live for 6 more turns at least, and that's going to be plenty.
And also, you don't need to worry about people. No one's going to swing at you.
They can't. They can, but it doesn't do anything.
People are going to generally swing at everyone else. The fact that this is prevent all damage, that's just nuts. That, again, this card does not exist anymore for a good reason.
Yeah, card is very good. If you're not playing with it, go pick some up, play with it. You'll not regret it.
Yeah, you'll see what happens. You
see what happens, Larry.
My number 3 is the one, the only, the brand new Command Beacon.
It's so new, I sort of forgot about it.
Yeah, I almost did too, actually. I read it online. I was like, oh, this is a good land. Thank goodness this forum post is recent.
Yeah.
It is from the Commander 2015 product. You can tap it to add colorless to your mana pool. You can also tap it and sacrifice Command Beacon, put your commander into your hand from the command zone. That text has literally never been seen before.
That's pretty nuts. It just gets you around commander tax.
It's good, it's really early good. Game. It's good late game. I think it's just overall very powerful. I really hope they print this in every Commander product from now on, because I don't want to pay, I think it's over $10.
Yeah, it was only $12-ish. In the one deck, or was it in two?
I think it was in one.
So it's just, yeah, that's just crazy. If you're going to create a card that's going to be ubiquitous like this one is, then you've got to make it so that we can get a hold of it. Like, that's crazy.
You got to do the Sol Ring treatment.
Yeah, the Command Tower treatment.
Yeah. This card's great, obviously. You can do it when your commander costs a little too much, and that's fine. You can do it when your commander costs a billion mana, and it's great.
I mean, it's super good in all these decks that one of the ways to, like, let's say Mizzix, mm-hmm. to sort of get a handle on Mizzix, a lot of people are saying you just have to kill Mizzix as soon as possible, like the first 3 or 4 times, and by the time they have to cast it the 5th time, it's so expensive that it's not actually, like, really threatening anymore, because even if they cast it, they have to tap out to do it, and then you're not under threat of all those counter spells like you would be. So this gets around that. It's so good.
Yeah, I enjoy Command Beacon quite a bit. I haven't actually gotten to play that much with it, but it's one of those cards where you just know it's that good.
It's that good.
We have to skip to number 1 now.
Yeah, my number 3 is High Market. My number 2 is Strip Mine. And your number 2, as we said, is Glacial Chasm. So we've talked about all the cards, except for, once again, and this often happens when we do these top 10 lists, is that we have very similar lists in the top 5, except for we still don't have number 1 being the same, which is always fun.
Yeah, I enjoy that quite a bit.
So I'll let you go first with your number 1.
My numero uno. It's a pet card of mine. It's obviously one that goes in. I put it in every single deck.
It's very good.
It's Ancient Tomb. It's a land. You can tap it to add colorless, 2 colorless mana to your mana pool, and Ancient Tomb deals 2 damage to you. On turn 1, this is essentially a Sol Ring.
Yeah, it's
on a land.
It's so
you play
good
this with
early.
Sol Ring. You have 3 colorless mana just to do whatever with on turn 1. It's very powerful. Now, obviously, 2 damage does add up over time. But again, we start with 40 life. The amount of advantage this gives you, I think, is pretty powerful and pretty prevalent in the early game to the late game. There have just been so many times when I look at my land base and go, man, if I just had one more mana, if I just had this much more, it would make all the difference in the world. So Ancient Tomb is just one of those lands that it's been around since Tempest. It just got reprinted as an Expedition. It was from the Vault Realms. It's up there for me. Obviously, for me, it's number 1. I just like the idea that you can just ramp to 2 mana with a single land.
It's extremely powerful, especially if you play on turn 1, the amount of advantage it gives you, because you have twice as many mana as everybody else on the first turn.
Yeah.
You have 1 more mana than everybody else on the second, 1 more mana than them on the third. Like, that's 4 more mana you've had by the third turn if you get it out on turn 1.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's not much else to say about it. And like you said, we have 40 starting life. And after a while, you can stop tapping it because you have enough other lands.
Yep.
that you only need to tap it when you need to, so you can sort of like stem that bleeding if you're worried about it, which probably you're not, because you got to tap it so many times for it to really...
Yeah, even tapping it for four turns, you're at 32 life out of 40. That's pretty good. I'll take that.
I mean, for the amount of advantage it gives you.
Yeah, the reason I also love it is it does go in my favorite deck, which is Marchesa, and this does exactly what you want.
Yeah, you actually want to lower your life total because of Dethrone.
And have the ability to lower it at instant speed as well.
Pretty sweet.
Pretty sweet. All right, Josh, your numero uno.
My number one is, and it was your number five.
Yeah.
And sadly, I did not have Ancient Tomb on my entire list.
It was on your honorable mentions, right? Clearly.
Yes. My number one is Maze of Ith. So Maze of Ith is a land. You tap it, and it says, untap, target attacking creature. Prevent all combat damage that would be dealt to and dealt by that creature this turn.
Cool.
It's just removal. It's just a land that says, oh, one creature is just taken out, is fogged, basically.
Yeah.
And you can do it to your own creatures. So if you're in, say, a Jaleva deck, a Kalia deck where you need to attack to get that effect, but you don't want it to then get blocked and die, you can do that. It stops, like, you know, the Xenagod decks where there's going to just play something huge, swing at you.
Yeah.
It is subject to Hexproof and Shroud and those types of downsides, but in general, a land that stops, and people know you have it. So you're sitting there with a Maze of Ith untapped and they can attack you, but they know it's just going to make you tap Maze of Ith. And we've said this many times, which is that people don't like to take an action and then have no result from that action. So they're just going to swing at somebody else. But then what does that do? Well, the next person goes and you still have the Maze of Ith untapped. They don't want to attack you because it's going to do nothing. So they attack somebody else. And then the next person goes. So it can actually hold off more creatures than you would think.
Even if you did tap it and bring one person down, I mean, unless you have four Voltron players around the table, the downside is, sure, other people can attack you if they force your hand, but at the upside, you're not dying that turn to Xu Yun or whoever is just going to murder you out of nowhere.
And you can also save or stop other people from dying or save their creatures or do all kinds of things that aren't even attacking you. So that's another upside of Maze of Ith. It does have political ramifications. Yeah, it's a really good card. I really like it.
I like it as well. All right, so those are our top 10 lands. Of course, we also always have honorable mentions. So let's talk about those bad boys real quickly. My first one is the Arcane Lighthouse. Now, this is kind of similar in effect to Homeward Path in a way. You can tap it to add colorless to your mana pool. You can also tap one and then tap it. Until end of turn, creatures your opponents control lose Hexproof and Shroud and can't have Hexproof or Shroud. So this gets around so many times when you're like, we have to get rid of that thing. Oh god, it's Hexproof. We have to get rid of that thing. It has Swiftfoot Boots, it has Lightning Greaves.
This is
the
anti-Narset card.
Yeah, absolutely. And for one mana to tap it, that's pretty cheap. It comes in untapped. It promotes teaming up with someone. If you're like, hey, look, I have Arcane Lighthouse. Can you get rid of that thing? Great, I will make it lose Hexproof. And guess what? It can't gain it back.
I love that play because you can be holding Swords to Plowshares and Utter End and whatever, but it doesn't feel like you're not doing your part. You're like, listen, I'll use Arcane Lighthouse, and then you use your kill spell. And you're actually doing that thing we always talk about, which is like getting somebody else to take care of the problem. But it feels like you're actually contributing, but you're not using a card, you know, out of your hand. You're just using an effect that you can do as many times as you feel like.
Tricky.
Yeah, that play is really good.
I enjoy that quite a bit. So Arcane Lighthouse is my the first of my three honorable mentions.
My first honorable mention is Boseiju, Who Shelters All. It's a legendary land. Man, I had a lot of legendary lands.
They're pretty legendary.
Yeah, it enters the battlefield tapped, but you tap it, pay two life, and add one colorless to your mana pool. If that mana is spent on an instant or sorcery spell, that spell can't be countered by spells or abilities.
Wow.
So in a non-blue deck, this just guarantees said instant or sorcery will get through. It'll resolve. It's not going to get countered. Very, very strong because, you know, Insurrection or Tooth and Nail or just there's a lot of instants and sorceries that you just are like, man, if I can just guarantee this gets through, then I have a chance in this game or I'll win this game.
Yeah,
a board wipe oftentimes is something that you just like, I need this to happen. And you can make sure it does if you have Boseiju.
Yeah, I enjoy the board wipe quite a bit with Boseiju. I enjoy the Insurrection with Boseiju. It's just, I mean, obviously you can pay two life to add one mana regardless.
Yeah, you can. I think people forget that you can still cast a creature spell with it. It just won't be uncounterable. If you use it on instant or sorcery, then it is uncountable.
Yeah, I mean, the insurance policy here is great, especially, I think the reason I didn't include this on my list is because it's very meta-dependent. If your meta just doesn't counter stuff, then you don't need to play Boseiju. But if everyone's running Counterspell, then this is a much better land in your group, so.
Yeah, I think our playgroup sort of skews towards a few Counterspells. We have, there's a few decks in the meta that are, like, dedicated Counterspell decks, but we don't play against them all the time, but I'd say in most games, there are like a few counter spells in a few decks. So
yeah,
you know those key moments, you might get countered.
Yeah, definitely. All right, my number two on the list is Tolaria West. This is one of Alex Kessler's favorite cards, actually, I'm pretty sure. Tolaria West enters the battlefield tapped. You can tap it to add blue to your mana pool. And you can also do one of the most broken abilities, I believe, in the game of Magic, is Transmute. So for one blue-blue, discard this card, search your library for a card with converted mana cost zero, reveal it and put it into your hand, then shuffle your library, transmute only as a sorcery. Hey, can we name some really powerful cards with converted mana cost zero right now?
Yeah, all the lands we just talked about?
Yeah.
Actually, I run this card in Mizzix just to get Reliquary Tower.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because Reliquary Tower is so important to that deck.
Yeah, it's a very important card. Tolaria West also fetches out, I don't know, Mana Crypt? I don't know.
Yep.
Pact of Negation.
If you own Mana Crypt.
Pact of Negation is a card that we all own.
Yep. So you can go get it really quick and use it.
Yeah. So the fact that you can get, like, a trump card. Pact of Negation to me is a total trump card in EDH. It's great. You can fetch out lands. Anything with CMC 0. The fact that you can play it as a land if you want, too, if you're really desperate, and it has this extra ability on it, makes me happy.
Yeah. Really, really good card. I actually forgot about this card and didn't even have it on my list anywhere. I'm so ashamed. Because
I do run it.
Yeah, I just didn't think of it. It's really good.
Yeah, it's good.
My second honorable mention is Bojuka Bog. Bojuka Bog is a land that comes into play tapped. When Bojuka Bog enters the battlefield, it's hard to say, exile all cards from target player's graveyard.
Don't.
And you can also tap it to add black to your mana pool. So it's a graveyard hoser.
Yeah.
Graveyard hate.
Hard to counter.
Yeah, it's just so good. I've had it hose me before. I've hosed people with it before. You know, you want graveyard hate, but you don't want to put a lot of it in your deck as cards that are going to be dead when you draw them. And this is a card that, like, if you've got black in your deck, which you have to run it, then it's not dead because you can just play it, and then it's just basically a swamp. It comes into play tapped, but it does, you know, work with your deck. It doesn't take anything away from it.
Yeah, absolutely.
In those games where you aren't worried about dredge or... Because graveyard recursion is kind of like air. And air is something you don't think about unless you don't have it. And graveyard hate's the same way. If you need it and you don't have it, you need it bad.
Yeah.
But if you don't need it and you don't have it, you don't notice it.
Yeah, and plus, again, the cost of playing this land is pretty low if you're playing black. It taps for the mana you want, and when it comes in, it may just do nothing, which is fine, but it may do a whole lot.
It may totally make it so one player can't even win.
Yeah, and it could do anything in between that as well. All right, my final honorable mention is Nykthos, Shrine to Nyx. It's a legendary land. You can tap to add colorless to your mana pool, or for two generic mana, you can tap it, choose a color, add to your mana pool an amount of mana of that color equal to your devotion to that color. So your devotion to a color is the number of mana symbols or pips of that color in the mana cost of permanent to control. This card is just great in any two-color deck, even some three-color decks, especially good monocolor decks. For two mana, if you have four pips of color out, three pips of color, two pips of color, it starts gaining you mana. At three pips, it'll get you... Actually, no, at four pips, it'll start netting you plus mana. Because otherwise you'd pay three mana to just add three colorless or three whatever. So this card can spiral out of control in the right decks. With untap abilities, yeah, it's even better.
It's like Cabal Coffers, where it's like under the right circumstances with enough pips out, somebody just manages to tap and untap it. And it, you know, you can do it with Voyaging Satyr. It doesn't even have to, or Fate Stitcher. It doesn't have to be anything exotic. And then all of a sudden you're like, wait, how many mana do you have? And you're like, well, I started with 12. And then I did this, and now I have 18, and then I untapped it, and now I have 37. You know, it's just like, what?
How'd you get an odd number?
Because I also tapped a swamp.
Oh, perfect.
Yes.
Yeah, so this card's great. I enjoy Nykthos. It is, to me, the very fair version of Gaia's Cradle. We've said that name Gaia's like six times.
Because I don't know how I'm supposed to say it. So I figure if I say it both ways, then I'm right sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I should pretend that we've always said it the one way. Yep.
I mean, how do you pretend that? I don't even know.
I'm pretending it right now.
I would also say now would be a good time to buy Nykthos Shrine to Nyx, because it's going to start creeping back up. It did rotate, you know, fairly recently.
Right.
It doesn't see a ton of play, like in Modern or anything. So, but every time they print a new black card or a new blue card or a new green card, it has a chance to just be, you know, all of a sudden like the card that everybody wants.
Yeah, totally.
And over time, it's just going to increase in value. So that would be a, we're not finance guys, but that would be my suggestion.
Yeah. Including this next land, depending on where it drops to as well, actually, for your
it's
final.
It's cheap now. Now would probably be the time to pick up Mirrorpool or soon. So that's my final. And this is kind of a speculative honorable mention. Mm-hmm. Because honestly, I haven't used it much. And I haven't seen it used much. And it may just be that our playgroup hasn't adopted all the new cards super quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just going to be very, very good. Like, down the line, I feel like this will be one of the cards that probably should make the top 10 list.
Yeah.
You know, if we were doing this again in 2 or 3 years, Mirrorpool might be my number 4 card. I don't know, but I feel like it's that power level. Mirrorpool is a land. Comes into play tapped. You can tap to add diamond to your mana pool, or you can pay 2 and a diamond, tap it, sacrifice Mirrorpool, copy target instant or sorcery spell you control. You may choose new targets for the copy, so it forks one of your spells. Or you pay 4 and a colorless, 4 and a diamond, tap and sacrifice the Mirrorpool, put a token onto the battlefield that's a copy of target creature you control, so clone one of your own creatures.
Jeez.
So it taps for colorless, it forks one of your own spells, or it clones one of your own creatures.
It just seems really powerful. Every bit of that ability on every... It's just like, I want all of that to happen.
It's on a land!
It's on a land.
It costs you very, very little. I think as we come to terms with colorless or diamond mana and really working out the kinks of putting in pain lands and blah, 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 so that, you know, you don't actually have to pay a real cost to have colorless diamond mana available to you.
Yeah, totally.
Mirrorpool will get more and more strong. And I think, you know, at least for me, I haven't gone through that process very much yet. And as I do, that'll make the card better and better.
Yeah, I agree. Mirrorpool is a fantastic card. It seems, maybe in the right decks especially, but who knows if it's sort of an all-around all-star.
I'm going to look it up on TCG Player because I feel like it's super cheap because it's not really seeing play.
It is very cheap for a mythic rare from a second smaller set compared to the big one.
Okay,
so
let's look here. What do you think it is, like a buck?
No, it's probably $4, $5. I could see it being as low as $2.50, depending on the seller, of course. That's a nice thing. Card prices always go up and down. Knowing when cards rotate out or cards just aren't being played in a new set that's been opened a lot is nice. It looks like it is actually close to $3. Yeah, $2.50 mint from a couple places. But with a little bit of shipping.
Just get a few of them. $2.50. It's never going to be this low again.
Yeah, it's a mythic rare. Not as many are going to be opened. So
there's no chance in like 3 or 4 years that it's not $5 to $10.
Yeah.
There's no chance.
100% agree with that there. All right. So that is it. Those are our top 10 lands in EDH. Thank you guys for listening. Now, to the listeners, of course, we want to know, we've done a lot of these top 10s, and we've done a lot of top 10s for the basic stuff. So color cards, artifacts, lands, but we haven't really delved deeper. So let us know in the comments on rocketjump.com/thecommandzone or youtube.com/thecommandzonepodcast or Twitter @commandcast. What top 10 lists have we missed?
Yeah, what top 10 lists do you want us to do next, or maybe we haven't thought of or wouldn't think of that you think would be cool for us to do?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, obviously we're here for you guys. We want to know what our listeners want to hear. So please let us know. We try and read almost pretty much every comment. We may not respond to everything, and especially not if it's a busy week like it has been for us. But I do read all the emails that come in. I read in every comment that I can, and it all goes filters into my head.
Speaking of comments, we had a ton of response to last week when we were talking about self-expression and deck building and having your own unique takes, and then we asked everybody what their sort of most unique deck was and what they were the most proud of. And we are going to choose one of those, and Jimmy's going to give them his extra copy of the Zendikar art book.
In the mail. So I did a random roll off, and I selected, this was from the Rocket Jump comments, so on rocketjump.com/commandzonepodcast, Ramiro Gomez. Congratulations, buddy. He said, my Thassa God of the Sea Krakens deck has to be my choice. And he said it's not a classic blue deck, so no counterspells so much. It's a lot of artifact ramp, of course, like Caged Sun, Extraplanar Lens. And it's got a lot of Krakens, Serpents, Sphinxes, and Leviathans. So that's pretty sweet. And, of course, Treachery and Great Whale are also in that deck.
It's awesome. Lands. Any deck that has Great Whale has to be good.
Yeah. And it actually fits the theme of Kraken, yeah. Serpents, Sphinxes, and Leviathans.
Water it's creatures.
Water in the air.
You got to have Whelming Wave in there, right, Romero?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
That's a house in that deck.
Yeah, exactly. Even Thing of the Ice is pretty good.
Yeah.
It's in the water. They dug it out of the ice.
That's true. How else did it get surrounded by ice?
Yeah, exactly.
If it wasn't in water.
Exactly. So, Ramiro, go ahead and send us an email with your address, commandcast@rocketjump.com. We will get that book out to you ASAP. And I will say this, actually. If you guys do enter a contest and you don't get back to us for like 3 months or 3 weeks even, or a month after, just try and, I don't know, get back to us sooner. It's tough because I try to do all the shipping as a batch group. It saves me time and money.
We should start putting deadlines on it within the next Ramiro, get back to us before the middle of May.
Yeah, that's a good deadline.
Yeah, if you're after that, we might just give this art book to somebody else.
Yeah,
I know Ramiro listens to the show like on time most weeks because he's often commenting. So I'm sure that we're gonna hear back from him.
Excellente. Well, looking forward to hear from you, Ramiro. All right, let's move on to the end step where we talk about something cool outside the world of Magic. Josh, looks like you've got something prepped up this week.
Speaking of books.
Books.
I recently saw Book of Mormon.
I love that musical.
It's so good, and I do not know. I'm ashamed a little bit because it took me so long to see it. I mean, I was a theater major in college.
Oh,
like,
true.
I love theater. Like, I love musicals. And anyway, Book of Mormon, it came through L.A., my girlfriend and I got to go see it. In fact, she bought us the tickets, and I just thought it was amazing.
It really is, and it does it. It tackles a very touchy subject in a way that also embraces it and condemns it entirely. It's amazing.
I mean, those guys, the Southport guys, are such geniuses. It's crazy how they dance around all that stuff, and they just strike this perfect chord.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I don't know what else to say, but it's completely brilliant. And some of the scenes they managed to pull off, some of the duality between what's happening is just so hard as a storyteller, and they make it seem so effortless.
In song format, no less. Not even like a traditional story.
It's crazy, the baptism song in there, and the way that they pull that song off, and I don't want to spoil anything, so is... You're just, as a person who works in entertainment, so jealous of somebody's ability to pull that stuff off in that manner and make it look so easy, and that's so hard to do. It's so hard to get the audience in that perfect spot that they're actually realizing like three sides of a conversation as it's happening to get all the little all the little cues that the audience is supposed to get, they're getting, and it's all complicated stuff. Anyway, I could go on and on. Book of Mormon, if you haven't seen it, it's brilliant. It's very crass.
Oh, yeah. As
the South Park guys are, it does serve a purpose. One of my favorite stories about, and I kept thinking about this when I saw the movie, is my parents went and saw it a few years ago. My mom's passed away, but the whole time that I was watching it, I kept looking over to my girlfriend, and we were just laughing because the thought of my mom sitting into the... was hilarious. And I remember after she saw it, we had a conversation about it, and she was shocked by the whole thing. She couldn't like it, because it was so, the language and some of the subject matter was so offensive to her. My mom was very conservative, which is funny because she went to Evergreen and Berkeley and was a hippie, but I guess this happens to us when we get older.
Suppose so. Can't wait.
But that was one of the funniest parts about sitting through it, was just thinking of my mom sitting there just being like, oh my gosh.
Especially because you talked to her afterwards.
Yeah, exactly. I laughed at her too. And I was like, Mom, come on.
Yeah.
You were a hippie. Like, come on. And she's like, I'm not a prude. And I'm like, you kind of are.
That's great.
If you have the opportunity, go see Book of Mormon. It's really, really good.
Even if you can't see it, listening to the soundtrack obviously is nowhere near experiencing the whole thing, but that's how I first experienced the musical. And even then, I was like, this is hilarious. What they're doing is fantastic. I don't even need to see it to understand sort of the humor they're getting at. So, yeah, I love that musical when I saw it. It was I blown away. Jealous is the right word.
Yeah, I'm totally jealous. I totally feel like inadequate. Like Matt Stone and Trey Parker are just, they're geniuses. They just are. Yeah. It also made me want to go to New York and go see some stuff on Broadway again because it's been a while since I did that.
Yeah, real Broadway.
Yeah. Speaking of stuff you should not miss.
Hey.
The Masters of Modern podcast is a podcast that you should not miss. They're our sister podcasts. You can find them on Twitter at the MMcast. They talk about modern as a format and all things competitive magic. The two hosts are Alex Kessler and Ben Bateman. They really know their stuff, and they have some awesome guests. Go check them out on rocketjump.com under the podcast tab right next to us.
Yeah, they also launched a Patreon recently, and they gave away a bunch of their favorite cards. I think it was Grand Architect and
Geist. They signed them and gave them away. So, yeah.
Which is really cool. So if you were on their Patreon, you just got a sweet free card for supporting the podcast, which is really nice.
So go sign up for their Patreon so you can get free stuff. That's another good thing about them.
Yeah, and Modern is obviously really exciting right now. So our editor for the show is the one and only Terry Robertson. Make sure you guys check out the work he's done on the show. Every show is getting better and better and better. Eli, who was our old editor, Terry's currently crashing at his place, was talking to me and said, oh yeah, I looked at Terry's timeline and how he edits these things now, and I was blown away at the complexity and the levels that Terry was going to. So that's really neat to hear. Terry does a great job. You can watch the videos on youtube.com/thecommandzonepodcast, and when you're there, you'll also see the animations from Jeffrey Palmer at Living Cards MTG. He has animated the intro and a bunch of other really cool stuff, so make sure you follow him on Twitter if you haven't already. He posts new animations, and it's always sweet to just watch them and be in awe of his abilities.
Yeah, the Sol Ring intro on the videos is worth the price of admission, which is zero. The price is zero.
Yeah, it's zero. Maybe it's an ad you have to sit through, but like you can click after it. After
it's
5 seconds.
Yeah. Yeah, we're not. All right, everybody. Thanks for listening.
And we'll see you next time.
Peace.
For your attention. For further inquiries, send an email to commandcast@rocketjump.com or ask us on Twitter at JF Wong and at Josh Lee Kwai. See you later, alligator.
Greetings, humans.